1, and this is Bob Gilgore interviewing Sylvester Hackney at the Chapel Hill Public Library.
Good afternoon, Sylvester.
Hello.
First of all, I want to thank you. I know you're a busy man, for taking the time to come here and talk with me today. I appreciate that. And I'll get right into it with a very broad question, and that is, what was it like growing up in Chapel Hill? I assume you did grow up in Chapel Hill.
I grew up in Chapel Hill. I grew up in a rural community just outside of Chapel Hill, just across the lake. I have actually a fairly large family, but my brother and I, we grew up with my grandparents, and my younger brothers lived with my mother and stepfather, but they were just across the way. You know, we could walk from my grandmother's house to their house. We had kind of a trail that we could hike over, and so there was a fair amount of interaction. We saw each other, you know, very often. But I would say, I call myself like a poor little rich kid. That we were poor by, you know, economic terms, but rich in that we had a very tight family structure, and we had all the things that we needed, and very bountiful meals, and we were always clothed and fed very well. Both my grandparents were hard workers, and my grandmother was, which worked as a kind of a maid for a university professor. I always remember she made $18 a week, and she was always very proud of that. And they even paid her during the summer when they went away on vacation. They paid her $18. It's pretty amazing to me that we survived off of my grandfather's Social Security, and he had a disability in the Army, and so he got a small pension from the Army, and then her $18 a week. It sustained us, but their house was paid for, be it ever so minimal. But it was good.
What did your grandfather do?
He was a farmer. My grandfather was a farmer. He never, during my life, had any, you know, regular employment. He worked a farm, and a large part of our living was living off the land. We had farm animals and cows and pigs and chickens, and pretty much we lived off the land. One of the things that I told you that I tend not to romanticize some of the things that have happened in this area, but I do romanticize that. I find it totally fascinating the way that we grew up. And, you know, we lived off the land, and didn't have anything extravagant, but it was good. My grandmother was a great woman. Every season, you know, there was something that she did to kind of sustain us. I mean, in the summer, there was all kind of berries and things that, you know, she canned jams and food, and in the winter, we ate that, and had meat from the farm animals, and they basically had to come into town, which was a huge trip at the time for us, because we didn't have transportation. We lived out across the lake, which technically is only about 3 miles, but it seemed like a lot further than, because there were dirt roads and weren't paved highways. But she'd come in town to get basic staples, salt, sugar, and those kinds of things. Otherwise, we were pretty independent, which is always one of my goals, to kind of get back to that life. As far as I get from it, you know, the more I want go back to it. So I do have a romanticized view of that, but in real terms, we had an incredibly, I guess it would have been very difficult economically to survive. We never were on welfare. We never were on free lunch programs. Every Monday morning, I had my $1.25 for lunch that week. I always paid for them. We had a book fee that we had to pay, and there were kids that, you know, just couldn't afford to pay it, and would spend a year, you know, having to answer teachers about that. But I always paid my book fee. early on, and I have an ongoing love affair with my grandparents for making all that possible. And college education was never, there was never any doubt in my mind but that, you know, I was going to go to college. And it was never, it was just like clockwork. This is the thing you do. And some people have asked me that, you know, how did you get to college? And it was just, there was never a doubt about that.
So your grandparents pushed you, or your parents, or both?
More my grandparents, probably, than my parents. But my grandmother, definitely. We lived out across the lake. What did you interview Berenice at? Did you interview
here?
We lived out across the lake, and back in the old days, before Lincoln High School, and before the Orange County Training School, there was a school called Buck Mountain. And Buck Mountain is the school that's kind of, it was on property that adjoined our property. So a lot of the kids in the old days that went to Buck Mountain actually stayed with my grandparents. They stayed at the house because the school was close by. So my grandmother kind of had a semi-teacher role with a lot of the kids. I mean, she wasn't a teacher, but in those days, I mean, she was a very well-read woman who, she was always also a Jehovah's Witness. And one of the things about Jehovah's Witnesses is that, for whatever else you think about them, that they really take their religion seriously, and they read and study and read and study and read and study. So I've always attributed a lot of her intellect to that, and that, you know, she read a lot just because of her faith. And so she always reinforced that, and that was always a big part of our life. And
religion was a big part of your
religion
life.
Reading was a big part of our life, but religion was also. I actually didn't choose to follow that faith as I got older, but I have nothing but positive things to say about it, and I think it was a very positive influence in my life because. Because of the reading, and also they travel a lot. You know, they have big conventions in the summer, and so we always got to go to these very interesting places, you know, New York and Baltimore and other places. Kind of, and I'm a big advocate of traveling and exposure to offset whatever your reality or perspective is. So I've always valued that part of my growing up, and attributed a lot of that to my grandparents. But, you know, in terms of the poor or rich kid thing, you know, even in college, you know, when I was in college, I mean, I always had everything that I needed, and if I needed money, I'd write home, and they never had a checking account or anything, but they'd wrap money up, send it to me. So, it was good. I have no gripes, except that in Chapel Hill, you have the classic story of the haves and the have-nots, and, you know, the university and the townspeople, and I'm probably one of those people that hate the local university. I'm always amazed at how people in the town, you know, kind of cheer and pull for UNC, because I have bitter perspectives of UNC and the way that it discriminated against the townspeople, and particularly the poor people.
Tell me more about that.
Well, it was a very, it was just like there weren't gates around the university, but there were invisible gates, you know, that you knew that you were not welcome on campus, you knew that they were the haves, and it was something that you kind of just, I guess you subtly get that message here that, you know, it's the university. Then it was certainly the university is kind of blended in with the town now, but then it was very, very different. I didn't feel welcome on the campus at all, and can remember walking through the campus sometimes and having, you know, the fraternity guys, you know, yell racial slurs out the windows or whatnot. I always remember walking down Cameron Avenue and some white guys, you know. So it just kind of didn't feel like it wasn't a pleasant experience for me, and I probably internalized that. And to this day, have never felt comfortable on the campus of UNC. And everyone who knows me knows that I'm the guy. You know, I belong to the ABC Club, anybody but Carolina, because I have that perspective that it is and has been a very racist institution. And one tends to probably idealize Michigan, and I'm sure Michigan has some of those same residuals for people who live in Ann Arbor, you know, and grew up there. But I always like to say Michigan graduated its first black student way back in the late 30s or 40s, and Carolina didn't do that until, you know, the 60s in terms of having a day student on campus, and to me that it baffles me. And one of the things I'll never understand is how intelligent people, you know, bright people, can allow something like that to happen, you know, to an institution of higher learning. It just baffles the mind. It baffles the mind. But anyway, that's my perspective of UNC.
I appreciate you sharing that. Let's go back to your childhood. And, it sounds as though you had greater exposure to what was going on in the world than the average person in the African-American community I've interviewed.
I don't have the benefit of that experience, so I don't want to necessarily compare it to other people. But I did have a good, every summer, you know, we traveled somewhere, you know, and usually I had relatives in New York, so whenever there were Jehovah's Witnesses used to have these huge conventions at Yankee Stadium in New York, so we would go up and just have a great time in New York City and amidst this religious convention. We got a chance to visit our relatives and, you know, would kind of, you know, do all the New York things with us. And I knew that there was a world beyond Chapel Hill and a world that I wanted to see. I always knew when I grew up that I was going to go to school a long ways away. I mean, it was kind of, wasn't an option for me to kind of pursue any, you know, the universities. I wanted to go far away. That's how I got to Michigan.
And what made you feel that way?
I'm not 100% sure. I'm not just that. Probably some deep-seated desire to explore and to see a different world. It wasn't necessarily a painful memory of any type. It was just a desire to explore.
Yeah, my comment before was based on the fact that there's a wide array of experiences among the people I've interviewed. Some of them grew up playing in black and white neighborhoods with black and white friends, but many of them grew up not being exposed, protected by the African American community, cradled in Potter's Field and Northside so that they wouldn't experience the pain of segregation. So there's a wide array of experiences, but none as varied, I think, as yours.
I think that in terms of looking at religions, which is another one of my interests, one of the things about Jehovah's Witnesses is that they've been integrated, you know, for a long, long time. Even during that period of time, you know, when we went to the conventions in New York, there were people from all over the world, you know, Africans, Asians, or you know, white folks, you know, from all over the country, black folk, and they prided themselves on that kind of blending of people. And looking beyond, you know, what was going on in what they call the world around them, and so that was an experience. It was a great experience. I wouldn't trade that in. I wouldn't trade that in. I'm happy. There are other parts of that religion that I detested, but you know, that part I think was a good thing. The exposure that, and the exposure and the reading. I'm a big advocate of reading. And, you know, when I'm talking about the educational system, usually that's one of the things I think we beat up the educational system a lot, but I think families have to make their kids read, and I don't care what you're reading, it doesn't matter a whole lot, but you need to read, and we had to read. I mean, we had assignments, and we had to go to book studies, and you know, all of that, and I think I got almost a gifted ability to read, you know, from that experience.
Did your grandmother read to you a lot when you were small?
Yes, who read to us, read with us. A lot of it was religion-focused, but still, you know, like, I'm sure you've heard of the Ouachita magazine. You had to, have you? No? Ouachita.
Ouachita.
The magazines that the that they kind of publicize their religion. But these magazines, you have to kind of read them, but they have questions after every article, and you have to kind of, you know, find the answer, know the answer, and that's a very useful skill, you know, just in life and reading and dissecting, and whether you agree with what you're reading or not is not so much of an issue, but it's pretty serious disciplining and learning that comes. It's a secondary gain almost, you know, from that. And so I attribute whatever intellect I have, you know, to a lot to that experience, a lot.
So there were a couple things you got from that religion, and that is seeing a society that accepted multi-ethnic
absolutely
principles.
Absolutely.
And also the intellectual aspect of it.
Yes.
Wonderful properties of anything, any institution.
Absolutely. Absolutely. But, I mean, now that whole experience had, I mean, I didn't like a lot of things in that, you know, you were pretty much, in some ways, a lot of people have described them as a cult because they encourage you not to do a lot of association with people outside of the religion because they have an abiding principle that, you know, bad associations spoil useful habits. And so that was always a struggle, you know, for us, is how much exposure should we have to the rest of the world and socially or even peer groups. My brother and I both have very strong personalities, so I think we decided that we wanted lots of exposure and we wanted to live in dual worlds. We wanted to do that thing, the religious thing, because that's what they wanted us to do and we weren't old enough to say no. But we also were determined to have normal exposure to whatever our peer groups were exposed to. And interestingly, I mean, it's kind of an interesting dynamic. We both broke away from that religion. My brother had gotten very active in the whole civil rights movement. And they came to him and said, you know, this is not what we believe in. This is not the way we believe that you kind of approach those issues. And if you're going to do that, then we don't think you should participate in the with the religion. And it was kind of like, we were delighted because we wanted to get out of it anyway. I mean, we wanted to doing all the other things that adolescent boys do, which were kind of against the principle. You have this big conflict going, and then they come along and say, well, you don't have to do it anymore because we don't like what you're doing. And so we broke away. We both broke away and never went back at that point, you know.
I'm really shocked. I mean, I'm really surprised. Here is a religion which accepts multi-ethnic groups, and yet they don't want one segment to protest against the unfairness that society has for them.
Yeah, to be outspoken about that, absolutely. Absolutely, that was the point that we broke with them. And he was older than I, and so he couldn't, I mean, they were kind of encouraging him, if you're going to do that, you know, then you don't participate with us. And so I was like, well, I'm going to do that too, so I won't participate with you either. And we both broke away. And I think, you know, it's one of the interesting things, because usually when people break away from that religion, it's for a bad reason, mm-hmm. like they've done something like adultery or fornication or, you know, like done something real bad. And I think they've always kind of been a little amazed at us that we're basically good, decent people, you know, and pretty much uphold the values that are important to them. So it's kind of always been, I think, a fascination, you know, with my brother and I that, you know, you push us out, but we probably turned out to live a lot better lives than a lot of people that stayed in the religion, you know, in terms of, I mean, not that we're so great, I mean, I've done pretty much everything there is to do, but basically a decent person.
When you were growing up, were your playmates mixed
No, I didn't play with any white kids. I didn't play with any white kids. Even though one of the fascinating things, and I've lived probably everywhere there is in this country, you know, worth living, you know, New York, I mean, I've lived in the Northeast, I've lived in Boston, I've lived in Chicago, out west, and I've always been probably a good ambassador for the South because people tend to beat up the South. And one of the things I describe to people, particularly in New York, is that in New York and Chicago, there's actually more segregation than there is in the South, and primarily in the rural South. Because out where we live, people tend to live on a lot of land, so you don't really care who lives next door to you, as you would in New York, where you really got to deal with these people day after day. So in my community, there were white people and, you know, black people, and we had reasonable respect. I mean, across the road from us, I mean, Benjamin Swalling, who was the director of the symphony here, was, you know, our neighbor, a university professor. And, but we had cordial respect, and but interestingly, there were no kid-peer relationships. And it was, the relationships were pretty much with the older generation, my parents, but primarily because they worked for them. And, you know, white folks have always been good to their housekeepers, or at least respected them, and had these kind of ambivalent relationships with them.
Any other things that you recall about your childhood that you want
to? Do I have any?
Now, I've always, you know, and I've wondered where I got it. I've always had a very an interest in race relations. Very strong feelings about the way blacks were treated in the South. I heard my grandfather tell stories about how he was treated. I remember probably one of the most painful memories I have in Chapel Hill was, as I told you, we only had to come in town on Saturday to get, you know, staples for the week. And my grandmother always shopped at a store in Carborough. It was right in the corner of there, Andrews and Rigsby's kind of grocery store. And it was the grocery store that most people around here went to that lived on that side of town. Every week she shopped there. I mean, that's the only place she would go in to buy her things. And one particular Saturday, and she liked the people. They were always nice. Lily, how you doing? And blah, 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 blah. How's Matthew? And all that. One particular Saturday, she had to go to the bathroom. I mean, she really had to go to the bathroom. And she asked them, you know, and they smiled at her and said, Lily, you know we can't let you use our bathroom. So she has to go, I mean, and this is like one of those times when you don't have a lot of options, you know. So she had to go out, you know, there's kind of a thing behind the store, and I always thought, you know, like, God help us all. Even as a little kid, and I was a little kid at this period, I thought, you know, what, you know, how demeaning, and white folks are really an interesting breed of people. I think experiences, moments, you know, moments like that, you kind of defined my perspective of the white people, just those moments. I remember my mother, she also did domestic work, and she worked for some couple in town, and she came home, she said she had knocked over some perfume, and she was dusting, and she just was kind of really shaken about the whole experience, and, you know, the way that they talked to her and treated her when they ended up breaking the district. You know, and I just, I know, things like that, just hearing those things, and I think it, I internalized them, and I taped them in my mind in a very powerful way, you know, so that those things, even as we speak, define a lot of how I perceive my exterior world. Seeing how black men are treated in this area, and I've always been totally fascinated by that. I've believed that a lot of the alcoholism in the black community, particularly amongst men, is because it has been so hard for men to assert themselves and to be human beings that you would expect men to be in this community. And I think you have to anesthetize those emotions. Don't allow people to actualize, then I think the psychic, you know, begins to get very oppressed and it has to find some relief. And I think a lot of the alcoholism, and I think there is a lot of alcohol, has been, you know, a lot of alcohol. And I don't deny that. And everybody in my family knows that I'm outspoken about it. I've seen alcoholism take a serious toll on particularly men of color.
Did you see this growing up, or did you see it more now?
Absolutely. And I felt strong about it growing up, and I feel strong about it now, and verbalize it growing up. It's interesting because when I went away to college and came back home, sometimes my mother, there's this joke in my family that they would hide the liquor when I came in, you know, because I had such strong feelings about it. And I've just seen it take a lot of tolls, a silent toll on a lot of people. And for a large part of my career, actually, that's kind of what I did. I ran substance abuse treatment programs in large cities. So not only did I feel strong about it, it's kind of, I made it part of my career out of it. I mean, I do something totally different now, but that was part of my career. I went to Michigan and got a degree in psychology and blah, blah, blah.
Let me go back to this comment that you made about the way black men were treated. Now, I've heard that before, and I've seen it. In fact, I just saw it on the way over here, where a policeman stopped someone. And it just seems it's still here, and it hasn't gone away. Maybe it's lessened, I don't know. But the issue that I want to get into is, why do you think black men were treated that way? And maybe black women weren't treated that way?
Well, I don't think black women have been treated a lot better. But I just think that because black women have been closer to the white family structure in terms of caring and nurturing, that they've gotten a little bit of a different affect, you know, from, you know, white people, you know, just a nurturing piece. And we don't nurture the kids. We basically, black men did the hard and brutal work. And I think that society has always been a threat and still is. I mean, it's something I struggle with even in my career now. Black male aggression is kind of something that I've always struggled with. I mean, if you ask people about me professionally, they'll consistently tell you that he's one of the brightest guys around here. He gets more work done, but he's just kind of a bear to get along with sometimes. And it's always fascinated me because I've always worked with what I thought were white men who were just like brutal. But they have this right to be nice sometimes, to be unhappy sometimes, to be abrasive sometimes. Black men and black people in general are not given that flexibility. And you see it in Chapel Hill, the students can be outrageous and very little is said about it. But if a group in the black community has that same rite of passage and gets involved in some of those activities, it's dealt with totally different. And particularly with men. I mean, I think it has to do with black male aggression. I mean, it's almost like if you have a dog and you mistreat that dog, you're brutal with that dog, you learn to fear that dog. Part of the fear is that you know if that caged animal ever gets away, that you're in trouble. And it's kind of and I've even had some of my, you know, white acquaintances who feel comfortable verbalizing their feelings say that to me. You know, if black people ever really, you know, rise up, then the world's in trouble. And I think that's kind of that fear factor that white folks have with black men, is that when you mistreat as much as we have been mistreated, then you have to fear, because you know that one day, some conditions, that caged animal is going to react.
Is that what your feeling is about how black men were treated 30, 40 years ago?
Absolutely. And that's my feeling about how they were treated 30, 40 years ago is how they treated at this very moment. I think I've seen it happen with, I saw it happen with James Peace, who was talking early on about heroes. James Peace, who was a principal of Northside and kind of migrated to some of the other school systems, was kind of, he was kind of my Rocco Gibraltar. But once this whole integration thing happened, I saw how he didn't get the respect. He was a man that basically, he was the principal of the school. I mean, he was a leader of a lot of black kids and has sustained, if you set objective criteria of what a school system should do, what a principal should do, and what really the outcome and the output should be, he met them. But yet when the school systems integrated, he had more and more of a diminished role. And I understand at the end of his career, was kind of pushed into such a diminished role that he retired.
Isn't that what happened to seeing at Google?
That's exactly what happened to him. He was my other Rocco Gibraltar. In fact, I can remember, I was a very mouthy kid, took no shit from anyone. I got a lot of that growing up. It was just, and a lot of that was defensive posturing, but be it whatever, I was very mouthy.